Acts chapter 2, verse 22, tells us, "You men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as ye yourselves also know. Him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by wicked hands and have crucified and slain, whom God hath raised up." Verse 22 tells us that Jesus was approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him. Over in Acts chapter 10, verse 37, as Peter spoke to Cornelius, he said, "The word I say you know, which was published throughout all Judea and began from Galilee after the baptism which John preached, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Ghost and with power, who went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed of the devil, for God was with him." So Jesus was a man of God, approved of God by miracles and signs and wonders and works. God did those through him, with him. He had the Spirit without measure. And in John chapter 20 and verse 31, we understand that Jesus did many wonders and miracles and works that are written, John 20 verse 31, that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing we have life through His name. So the miracles that we have recorded by Jesus are there to show us that He is the Son of God, and we can believe that He is the Son of God. And so what we're going to do this morning, you begin turning to Mark chapter 4. In Mark, we'll stay mainly in Mark 4 and 5 and look at some of these miracles of Jesus that help us see that Jesus is the Son of God. We see His healing, His power over earth and sky and or wind and sea, and we see His healing and the demons that He cast out, showing us that He is approved of God. In Mark chapter 4, these are real. Thank you very much. These are really neat stories that we're going to be looking at, where Jesus shows His power over wind and sea, and over demons and over disease. In Mark chapter 4, so what we'll do in just an outline of what we'll look at: Jesus stills the storm at Galilee. He heals the men possessed of demons at Gergesa, and He heals Jairus' daughter, the woman that had an issue of blood also. Jesus heals two blind men and a man possessed of demons that was mute. A couple of different accounts, and we'll not look at that just yet. That's with the demoniacs of Gergesa. In Mark chapter 4, they were on the Sea of Galilee, and there arose a great storm, a storm that really the disciples felt the peril of the situation, didn't they? One account tells us that there was a great storm. This account tells us there was a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship so that it was now full. Matthew's account tells us that the ship was covered with the waves. Luke's account tells us that they were filled with water and were in jeopardy. So the disciples, certainly in human terms, you'd see, you can just imagine what you would feel like if waves were covering the ship and the ship was filling with water. They recognized the peril of the situation. You just imagine thinking, well, what's going to happen? Going to capsize and just sink to the bottom of the lake? And they felt that. In human terms, the situation was bleak. But And they came to Jesus, and they came to Jesus, and we see their desperation. You know, "Lord, save us." So they evidently felt that Jesus could do something here for them and save them from this situation. In Mark's account, they say, "Master, Carest thou not that we perish? Master, does it not bother you that we're about to die? We're about to perish. Lord, save us. Master, we perish. You know, the pleading here in their voice, you might can hear, Master, save us. So it's understandable in human terms. But they needed to trust and that it would be all well with Jesus there. As we'll see later, Jesus says, you have no faith. You know, what is it? That He wanted them to have a faith without fear in this situation. He was there. You know, He had healed. He had cast out demons. They could, it was possible to understand that Jesus was able to help in that situation without the great fear that they had. They needed a trust that cast out fear. So, you know, a true assessment of their situation was that peace and safety was ahead. But they couldn't see through the storm that was raging around them. They just couldn't see that. And, you know, I think it's worthy to us to recognize that, you know, we have storms in life and we don't want to lose hope. We don't want to lose trust. In Luke chapter 18, Jesus spake a parable, and we'll just look at just this preface to the parable. He spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. Don't give up. Ought always to pray and not to faint. In one sense, the Lord is there with us. To those who love the Lord, to those who are with Him, who are in Christ, He will help according to His will. We have no fear in that. In Acts 17 and verse 27, one of the statements that Paul made in the city of Athens, he said, though He be not far from every one of us, God set bounds upon us. He's not far from every one of us. You know, Jesus is there. God is there in the storms of life. Don't faint. Don't lose heart. God is there. And He will help according to His will. In 1 John 5, 1 John chapter 5, and verse 14 and 15. This is the confidence that we have in Him, that if we ask anything according to His will, He heareth us. If we know that He hear us, whatsoever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we desire to Him. So He's not going to give us anything we ask, but according to His will, He will hear us. And it may just, and we want the Lord's will to be done, you know, just as Jesus did. Lord, Thy will be done. We want His will done in our lives, and it may be that we don't see what is prepared for us, what is the Lord's will. But we just need to trust Him. In Romans chapter 8, but we know, Romans 8 verse 28, that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to His purpose. And later on down in chapter 8, what can separate us from the love of God? What can? Nothing. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Verse 35. Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Verse 39. Nor height nor depth nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. So those who are in Christ can call upon God, and He is with us according to His will. And not very far from every one of us. So we just need to be able to see through the storm and recognize that God is with us.
Brent, just before we go on.
No, go.
I wonder about the impact that this is not the only case in which you saved them from a storm. And the impact of that on their psyche, on their faith, it had to be profound. Being a relatively small vessel in a violent storm, it breaks you down. If you see someone healed, recognize the power of God's Word. But you're not in peril. That's outside of you. That's over there. When you're caught in the clutches of the storm, you don't feel like you're in a vessel. You feel like you're in a film. And people who express no concern for God at all, unashamedly fall down and pray. You sense inherently the strength of the ocean and how outmatched you are. And it breaks you down. When you see, when they saw him say, peace be still, and it was, you recognize. recognition of the power, the physical power that God has, that he has. We see it in their reaction. They were extremely, who could this be? They knew who it was. Who could this be who can do this sort of thing? They understood his power in a new way. They had to reflect it on that over the years as they saw physical situations outside of their control. This guy, he can do anything. I remember that. I remember that sea that was about to swallow us.
And I should have known that. I should have just let you teach this first part about the sea and the ship. That's very good. Just to read back over what we didn't read it. And so just you brought it out there. And he arose and rebuked the wind and said unto the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said unto them, "Why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said one to another, "What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So yes, it's different when you're looking at something and someone's trying to teach you something and you're just listening, rather than when you're going through it yourself. I was looking at an article about some man who had the job of teaching downed helicopter pilots how to get out of a helicopter, and as this thing was sinking or whatever. And so it's a lot different to if you're right there and having the panic of the situation, difference in seeing something done and being in the situation and things going apart around you. But they saw and they felt all of that, and then they felt the great calm after Jesus showed his great power over the raging sea. In Mark chapter 5, any other comments? In Mark chapter 5, they came over into the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. Just looking at the difference in a couple of accounts of this, the country of the Gergesenes, country of the Gadarenes. I was looking, in this area, there were the cities, the 10 cities, the Decapolis. And as I understand, Gadara was one of those, and I think Gesera was another one of those 10 cities. And I don't know if Gesera is another spelling or another way to say Gergesa or not. So I don't know if both of these cities were part of the Decapolis or not, but in this country, in this area of that region across the Sea of Galilee, Jesus came to this area, and he met a man that had an unclean spirit. In fact, two men. In Matthew 8:28, Matthew's account says that there were two here, and even as they were two, they still were not alone. They had a legion of demons within them, many spirits. And in Matthew chapter 8, verse 28, there were many in them. And this man, what was he like?
Uncontrollable.
People tried to control him with chains. Didn't do any good. He broke them. One account says that no man passed that way. And where did the man live in this region? In the tombs, okay. I guess a fitting place for demons. And just by the way, I believe we understand, I believe, that right from Zechariah 13, that demon unclean spirits have passed out of the land. There are no more unclean spirits today. But there were then, and Jesus was going to show his power over these spirits. He showed his power over the elements. Now he's going to show his power over demons. But the power of these spirits over the man was great. These demons had control of him. These two men were bound by these demons. But even though there are no more demons roaming the earth today, God has bounds placed on Satan. God has bounds placed on us, like in Acts 17, verse 26. Hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed, and the bounds of their habitations. Of God binds us, and he also binds Satan. He binds Satan today to a degree that, how? What can Satan not do to us today? we're maybe talking about a physical overpowering there with these two men. That's right. That's exactly what I think of in 1 Corinthians 10:13. There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. So Satan is bound today in that sense. He cannot tempt us above what we're able, and God knows us, what we can handle in temptation. So we just need to take that way of escape. But we don't need to underestimate Satan. Satan is certainly powerful. Think back to what was it said about Peter? What did Jesus tell Peter about Satan? He had desired to sift him as wheat. No doubt Satan could have done that. But Jesus prayed for Peter that his faith fail not, and that he would strengthen his brethren. So we don't need to underestimate the power of Satan. So, you know, even the angels. The angels are greater in power than in might than man. We don't need to underestimate Satan, but recognize that God will help us. He'll allow no temptation above what we're able. But we do, according to Ephesians 6 and verse 12, we do wrestle not with flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. We wrestle against Satan, and he's not a small foe. So we need to understand that. So here, these demons, they physically overpower this man. He had been often bound with fetters and chains, plucked asunder by him, fetters broken in pieces. Neither could any man tame him. He saw Jesus and he ran and worshipped with him. Jesus told the demons to come out of the man. And they pleaded with Jesus for what? What the demons were asking Jesus, don't do something. Okay, don't torment us, don't throw us into the abyss. Just so happened that there was what nearby? Some swine. How many?
2,000.
And a lot of hogs. So they said, Jesus, don't torment us. And interestingly, they recognized who this was, didn't they? What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? You know, Jesus is not... We read there some passages at the very beginning showing us that with many wonders and mighty works, Jesus, he was a man of God approved by God by these works. And these are written that we might believe that he's the Son of God. Jesus wasn't just a man. Jesus wasn't just a prophet. He was the Son of God. And even the demons recognized that. And they said, send us into the swine. I don't understand this. Just stuff about the demons, I don't understand. You know, what did it buy them? You know, they rushed into the... Jesus gave them leave to go into the swine. They rushed off the cliff and were choked in the sea. They didn't go to torment at that point. So there's things about it that I don't understand. You know, there's the parable, or there's the story about the spirit that we just read about earlier in a previous lesson. You know, he walks about in dry places, finding no rest. I don't know how or if that enters in to this picture about being willing to go into the swine or not. Anyone have comments about what's going on with this? But Jesus didn't send him to torment, but the abyss at this point.
One thing that we see about spirits is that they desire to be in a boat or a body of some kind. And for instance, when resurrection is being described for us, we're going to be given spiritual bodies. It appears in different places that spirits desire in a boat or a body, and they don't want to be outside of a boat or a body somewhere.
Okay. We'll be clothed one day. With a body that God would give us, like unto His glorious body. Okay, so maybe that's the... So any spirit wants an abode. But Jesus gave him leave to go into the swine. And the man... let's see. the man came to Jesus. He wanted to be with Jesus. And what did Jesus tell this man that had been man or men to do after he had cast the demons out? Okay. Go tell your friends how the Lord has had compassion on you and all of the great things that God has done for you. He departed and began to publish in Decapolis how great things Jesus had done for him, and all men did marvel. And you can imagine after this, as we go in now into the story of the Jairus and Jesus healing his daughter and the woman that came behind Jesus in the press. Here's the fame of Jesus spreading abroad. People are coming to him in masses to be healed of him. Jesus was passed over again by ship unto the other side, and much people gathered to him, and he was nigh to the sea. And behold, there cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and besought him greatly, saying, My little daughter lieth at the point of death. I pray thee, come and lay thy hands on her, that she may be healed, and she shall live. So Jairus had faith, didn't he, to ask Jesus, request of Jesus, that Jesus come and heal his daughter. Well, so Jesus went with Jairus. And so he was a ruler of the synagogue. Not many mighty of the world will believe on Jesus, but here was one who did, this ruler. And so Jesus went with Jairus, went home with him, and much people followed him, thronged him. And there was a certain woman. What was it about this woman that, what was it about her that was unique?
She had a bleeding problem for a long period of time, 12 years.
12 years, okay.
And she went to all kinds of doctors, spent all the money she had trying to be healed from
In fact, got what? Okay. So she had this faith that I know what I'll do. I spent all the money. I've just gotten worse. These doctors aren't doing a thing for me. Haven't done a thing for me. I'll just touch. She'd heard of Jesus. She'll touch his garment. I'll be healed. So she came behind him in the crowd. You can maybe just picture the woman groping after Jesus, and she gets that, touches that garment. And one account tells us that immediately she felt the blood in her body, the bleeding staunch. Immediately she was healed.
Jesus said, "Even until the power leave this, leave him."
Another one account says he felt virtue leave him. In Luke 8:44, she was healed immediately.
Verse 25 says straightway.
Okay. Okay, straightway. Okay.
I think there's two things at play here in this particular passage worth noting. Is that you can imagine Jesus going through throngs of people and people reaching out and touching him. We don't have any records of any others that just reached out and immediately knew that they were healed. But this one believed that that particular thing would heal her. And because of that combination of the two, the power that was there and the belief that it would do it combined.
Okay. So there are different accounts of healing, there are different circumstances. Later on, as we'll see, Jesus asked these blind men, do you believe that I can do this? And so here this woman, she believed that this is what I need to do. Other times Jesus may have just... of course, when raising the dead, there's no belief there on the part of the subject. But so the different types of different accounts of healing.
Well, she reached out and been touching him, but it was not that was not a one way thing. It was not that her reaching out and touching him did anything. God did. God
helped. Okay.
There were people that like Mary said, that touched him all the time. Sure. But God would have known what her purpose was for doing that over there. It wasn't, I think it would have been a one-way street. It wasn't because
okay.
He tapped into something that God didn't know was already there.
Okay.
Her faith in coming to him allowed God to do what he would do.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Straightway, verse 29, the fountain of her blood is dried up. Who touched me? Verse 31. The disciples say, Lord, these multitudes are around you and you want to know who touched you? And virtue's gone from me, has come from me. And the woman, verse 33, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. And he said unto her, daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace and be whole of thy plague. And while he was talking, someone came from Jairus' house and said, Jairus, don't bother the master anymore. Your daughter's dead. And Jesus turned to Jairus and he said, don't be afraid. Believe. And he suffered no man to follow him, save Peter and James and John, the brother James. And he comes into the house of the ruler of the synagogue and seeth a tumult and them that wept and wailed greatly. And when he was come in, he saith unto them, why make ye this to do and weep? The damsel is not dead, but sleepeth. All right, someone explain why he said that. What's going on in his wording, possibly. Some things I think about. And, you know, like the first part, the damsel is not dead. Maybe just break it apart. The damsel is not dead. Well, what do you mean?
One thought, I'm not sure this is exactly what's going on here, but in prophetic scriptures, the prophets speak, many times they speak as only God can, that things aren't. He speaks of things that are not yet as though they were.
Okay, and Romans.
That's very common in the prophets.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's why he uses that phraseology here, but...
Because later on it does say that her spirit returned into her. And what does James tell us about the body and the spirit in James 2? Body without the spirit is dead. James 2:26. So her spirit returned in her. But he says the damsel is not dead. Maybe he was meaning, he had in his mind, she was not dead in the sense that she yet lived. Like, remember the Sadducees' question with Jesus, or the Sadducees' issue with Jesus in Luke chapter 20? Luke 20, verse 38. The Sadducees, they didn't believe in angels, spirits, the resurrection. And Jesus, I was talking to them about that they didn't, they erred, not knowing the Scriptures, nor the power of God. And he said about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he says in verse 38, for he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him. So everyone's living, whether they're here on the earth or not. All live unto him. She's not dead. Maybe in the sense that she's still alive. In fact, she's going to come back. God is not the God of the dead, but the living, for all live unto him. She's not dead, but sleepeth. So maybe here's a figure, here's the body. It's sleeping. When it's reanimated with the Spirit, you know, it'll wake in that sense. Like John 11, verse 11, with Lazarus. These things said he, and after that he saith unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. And they thought he was spoke about taking a rest and sleep. And he had to clarify. He said, no, verse 14, Lazarus is dead. But he used the term that Lazarus is sleeping. In other words, here's a figure. His body is lying there, but when it's reanimated with the Spirit, it'll awake in that figurative, in that sense. Well, so the damsel's not dead. She's lit. Her spirit's alive. And she'll come back, and her body will live.
First four chapters,
where are you? Okay. All right. The sickness is not unto death, John 11:4, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. So again, the basis of all of this is that these things help us to see that Jesus is the Son of God. God was with him. He was approved of God by these miracles and signs and wonders. He had power over wind and sea. He had power over the demons. He had power over death. So Jesus comes in and he put them all out. He takes the father and the mother, the damsel, and them that were with him, and entereth in where the damsel was lying. And he took the damsel by the hand and said unto her, Talitha kumi, which is by being interpreted, damsel, I say unto thee, arise. you know, which one is it? You know, you, since, you know, translation destroys meaning, doesn't it? No, of course, no, it doesn't. Here's two words translated into four, is it? Five, three, four, six. Damsel, I say unto thee, arise. But so here, Talitha Kumi, which is being interpreted. Here's also what he said. Damsel, I say unto thee, arise. So Jesus raised this 12-year-old girl from the dead, and they were astonished with a great astonishment. And he charged them straightly that no man should know it, and commanded that something should be given her to eat. Any other comments on? Up to this point, Jesus' power over wind and sea, the demons, or the death. Look at another few examples of his miraculous powers here in Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, verse 27. When Jesus departed thence, two blind men followed him, crying and saying, "Thou son of David, have mercy on us." And when he was come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus saith unto them, "Believe ye that I am able to do this?" And they said unto him, "Yea, Lord." Then touched he their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, be it unto you." And their eyes were opened, and Jesus straightly charged them, saying, "See that no man know it." So here he said, "You know, do you believe that I'm able to do this?" And they said, "Yes, according to your faith, be it unto you." When they were departed, spread abroad his fame in all that country. And as they went out, behold, they brought to him a dumb man, a mute man, possessed with a devil. And when the devil was cast out, the dumb spake. And I was looking at something that Bob was writing. I don't know if it's in this lesson. I think it was. Are these spirits? Are they just diseases or something? Like, you know, I don't understand. I guess I don't understand what. You know, and he was saying, his answer was no. You know, these were demons, not just simply some kind of figurative way to refer to a disease. But I really don't understand why one would think that it might just simply be a disease. You know, he was speaking to the legion of demons earlier. He was speaking to them. Satan's real. His demons are real. They no longer are overpowering us today in this same kind of sense, but they were certainly real. And just looking at the words of the text, when the devil was cast out, they brought to him a dumb man possessed with a devil. A couple of reactions to this in verse 33. The multitudes marveled, saying, "It was never so seen in Israel." And certainly it wasn't, was it? Because he was a man of God, man approved by God, by these miracles and signs and wonders that God did, so that we can believe that he is the Son of God. They'd never so seen it in Israel, but there were the Pharisees that said, "He cast out devils through the prince of the devils." We've looked at that before. Why would Satan cast out Satan? No, he's showing his power over Satan and over the demons. Comments or questions?
This verse right here goes just like what you said. Even the Pharisees recognized.
Oh, yeah.
He cast out devils.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, the Pharisees would rise up in judgment against someone in a figure of speaking to say, you know, no, that wasn't a disease. You know, because they're accusing it him of casting out demons by the power of Satan. Yeah, that's a great point. Verse 34. Yeah, so using the enemies of Jesus to show the explanation of the devils here.
Yeah, I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah.
It seems to be a knowledge of the Old Testament.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I saw Brother Bob's comment on that. I believe it was him. I think of Zechariah 13 that speaks about the unclean spirits would pass out of the land. So that I'm not sure. Maybe there's not an account that we have of that actually occurring. But though we know from Zechariah that at least the prophet Zechariah was aware of the concept of unclean spirits.
Now he was prophesying about the demons that would pass away, that were during the time of Christ.
Yes, that's what okay. So he just knew in prospect of the occurrence, the coming occurrence. Okay.
That's why I'm
that yeah, okay. Well, that's all I have. Any other comments?
People today are trying to say these demons were diseases back then. It'd be the same people that would have laughed when Jesus said the young lady is sleeping. Now, they don't understand the spiritual world and the life after death, and that there were demons and angels. That's why they laughed. They didn't understand that death wasn't final, and Jesus did and showed them.
Joy? Oh, that's right. That's right. I've forgotten about that. Saul. Sometimes the Pentecostal types may make the argument that the Spirit of God cannot dwell in an unclean temple. God can do whatever He wants to do. And Saul, I believe, is a good example. Here Saul was out to kill David. And he fell down and prophesied. I'm mixing my things. So the Spirit of God overpowered Saul there, and came upon him that he prophesied. But when he was trying to kill David, talking about an evil spirit from the Lord. Okay. An evil spirit would, okay, and that would soothe. Okay. I need to go back and look at that instance, but that may be an example of an unclean spirit. Sorry, I was mixing my topics there.
Yeah, and in that passage, I think of that as not the same as demon possession as we see it in the New Testament.
Okay, so a different type of...
It was an unclean spirit from the Lord. And that could mean that in the same sense that the Lord gives us up to our own passions, in the sense that Saul was okay. Bent on getting David, and his jealousy and bitterness towards him was from the Lord, in the sense that the Lord gave him up to do that, and it may not have been.
He allowed it.
An actual demon from the realm of Satan came and did that.
Okay. I have to look at that. But so God allowed 1 Samuel 16. I know that. I know that God may.
Today we might refer to someone as being mean spirited there.
Oh, okay.
A disposition or an attitude that plays in the way that they act. Not necessarily one of possession which that individual is driven that way, but they've allowed themselves part.
Okay.
I think that's the way that Saul had drifted away from the Lord, and is now being spirited toward David.
And I want to go back and look at it again. I'm holding out for the possibility of the other explanation. So I want to look at that more.
What I said was not completely
wrong,
because it was before David, or Saul was so bent on getting David. That was actually before the story of David and Goliath. So I was misremembering the place when I met.
But God can allow things to happen. In some places, it may say that He sent something or did something. Well, I can think of, this is kind of a rabbit, but think about Pharaoh. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But then in another account, it said Pharaoh hardened his own heart. So God may allow things to happen. God allowed, in our accounts, spirits to possess men, evil spirits to possess men. And He allows Satan to tempt man today. But He does rein Satan in and give us the opportunity to escape from that temptation. But maybe more to say, but I'll stop there. Any other comments?
Before we leave, this spirit possessed all of that, when the Spirit of the Lord left, and they discussed the Spirit from the Lord. In other words, that specific spirit that Paul had was not from Satan, as these demons were, like Eric was saying, it's just spirit from the Lord.
And that's what I'm thinking of when I mention that God, it may be said that God does something, but He's only maybe allowing it. Like when God hardened Pharaoh's heart, He sent all these plagues. And those plagues caused, you know, Pharaoh looked at that and said, no, I'm not going to give in to that. I'm not going to recognize God's power. So the plagues from God were a test to Pharaoh, and maybe in one sense God hardened Pharaoh's heart through the plagues that He sent, but Pharaoh looked at that and hardened his own heart. It could be, I'm thinking, that God sent this spirit in the sense that He allowed it, but I want to hear more.
The Spirit of God, because if capitalization has anything to do with it, of course, the Spirit was departed and capitalized.
Okay.
And the other spirit is a small
letter. Okay. I want to suspend more judgment and study that. Thank you. Thanks for all the comments.